This is Jerry Pippin. Welcome to the UFO Files, another broadcast from the International UFO Museum and Research Center here in Roswell, New Mexico. And we have probably one of the premier researchers as far as Roswell is concerned, and that's Tom Carey. He has a book out called Witness to Roswell, and you wrote that with Don Schmidt, right?
That's right.
Is it out already?
Yes, we wrote it last year, and it's been out a little less than a year.
And basically, you were involved in the digs too, correct?
Correct.
Why don't you tell us, bring us up to date on what happened there exactly?
Oh, sure.
And we'll talk about the book a little bit.
Sure. The Roswell archaeology dig was something that Don and I had always wanted to do. Well, when we both were members of QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. The QFOS conducted a preliminary dig in 1989. The plan was always to go back and to conduct a full-scale dig rather than just a preliminary dig.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the funding was never there, so when Don Schmidt and I hooked up together exclusively to work together in 1988, one of the first things that we did was to put together a proposal to try to find funding from somebody to allow us to conduct the dig. At that time, the Sci-Fi Channel was embarking on a UFO project, and we were put in touch with the Sci-Fi Channel by a third-party intermediary, and that was May of 2002, and the dig followed 3 months after that.
And of course, that was the big discussion last year, and you've had a year since then. What came out of that dig? Did we find anything at all?
The dig. Don and I had several.
First of all, I guess we probably need to explain that this was done scientifically through the University of New Mexico.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being that we had been to the crash site a number of times, and we didn't want to be in the position of discovering a piece of physical evidence without the authority of somebody who was controlling the site, a nonpartisan. We didn't want to have an Uncle Harry type situation where, you know, Aunt Lucy or Uncle Harry said, "Look what I found," and then try to go public with something like that. We wanted it to be a strictly controlled situation with archaeologists there. And if we found something, they could record it as they would any other archaeological find. So that's what we had in mind, and we approached the University of New Mexico, and they were willing to do it, much to our surprise, and they were actually eager to do this because it's a New Mexico story.
So basically you were looking for foreign objects of any kind?
Physical evidence, yes. We had certain things we were hoping to find. The first, the biggest item, of course, would be a physical piece of the ship. Most notably, what we call the memory metal, where you could curl it up in your hand and put it down on a flat surface, and it would unfurl without a crease, and you couldn't cut it, burn it, scratch it, or anything. That's what we were hoping for. On down the line, any other piece of the ship that had a hardness that we can't duplicate, and the minimum thing that we were hoping to find was evidence of a gouge. Now, it's been reported by certain witnesses that they recall seeing a gouge where this thing allegedly struck
dug
the earth,
dug
right. in the ground. Now, this is hard ground out there. This would, if we found evidence of a gouge, it would eliminate a weather balloon or a mogul balloon, any type of balloon array. So that's what our expectations and hopes
were. Did you find that gouge?
Yes.
I thought I'd read that.
Yes. We have pictures of it, and to us it forms a perfect V in the subsurface, the substrate soil, where it's all been filled in the ensuing 50-odd years. But if you take a slice of it, like you're slicing through a piece of birthday cake, you can see the layers, and you can see almost the perfect V in the soil, and to us that's evidence of the gouge.
Have you received any other interesting information out of this examination from the University of New Mexico yet?
The artifacts, the University of New Mexico termed anything that was found that could not be identified by them, they would call them HMUOs. It stood for historical material of uncertain origin. Now, something like a projectile point from a Native American is not a HMUO. It's an artifact, but it's not a HMUO because its origin is certain. So anything that they couldn't identify went into a bag for analysis.
And I heard you had quite a few bags.
Well, we also did soil samples, and this is also interesting. We did find a number of HMUOs, things we found out in the desert underneath the surface of the soil that the archaeologists couldn't identify. We also, what we did is we took soil samples of the soil around the area of the gouge where this thing impacted. And according to the archaeologists, the laboratory analysis that they normally do for such things, because the archaeologists do that all the time when they excavate a site. They examine the soil contents. And as I understand it from Dr. William Dolman, the lead archaeologist, the soil samples from the area of the gouge differed from what they call the control samples from away from the site. So there was a difference in content. What that difference is at this moment in time, I don't know, but we think it's something significant.
Are we awaiting a further examination report from them?
The examination
report. I'm kind of curious where it stands.
Yes, where it stands is, and not to promote our book, but we're here,
that's part of the deal. It's an interesting read too.
The book that is coming out next week. It's called The Roswell Dig Diaries, and it's published by the Sci-Fi Channel with major contributions from Dr. William Dolman, the lead archaeologist, myself, and Don Schmidt. The final report from the dig of 2002 is a chapter in the book. Now, I've just gotten my copy, so I haven't read it, so...
Is Sci-Fi Channel going to do another feature on this as well?
That is the plan. Mm-hmm. That is the plan. I understand, however, the Sci-Fi Channel has actually been purchased by NBC.
Yes.
So...
I don't know how that impacts everything. They
correct.
They were really doing some pretty innovative things there for a little while.
Yes, yes. So, right now, certainly Don and I plan to go forward with a follow-up dig, irregardless of who funds it. Certainly Sci-Fi has the first shot at this because they were so good to us in funding the original. And if they said today, let's go do it, we that's the way it would be. But irregardless, we have to move forward on this follow-up dig, and that's our plan.
Now, you live in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, just outside of Philadelphia.
Now, how did you get interested in Roswell?
Well, as a teenager, I was interested in UFOs. And then when I read the original Roswell book, The Roswell Incident, 1980, that was it for me. I said, this is the most...
You were hooked.
I was hooked. This is the most interesting aspect of the UFO phenomenon is what they call crash retrievals, because it has the promise of physical evidence.
Oh, I agree with you.
That not only statistically is there other life in the universe, but that it actually came here.
Now, you've been studying UFO crashes other than Roswell, too, I'm sure, not necessarily.
Actually, no.
No, you haven't. Okay.
No.
You've just been locked in on this one. This is the one.
This is Attorney Frank Galvin said in the film The Verdict, played by Paul Newman, this is the case, this is the only case. Don Schmidt has a day job, I have a day job, so there's only so many hours in the day. And I know Don for the last, I'm not a good mathematician, since 1988 and myself since 1991, This is the only case that we have been investigating.
Okay, you've been working at least a decade and a half on this project. What's the first thing that comes to my mind when you talk to somebody that's been involved in something over a period of years like that is, did it turn out at this point like you thought it might when you started?
When I started, I certainly said, you know, based on the original book and then the work that Randall and Schmidt had been doing, my curiosity was certainly piqued, and I was sympathetic to what they were saying. Now, in investigating the case, the investigation has been much more difficult than I had imagined.
That's what I was getting to, is you're from Pennsylvania. You probably, I don't know if you've been out in this part of the country or in the world before, but it's...
21 times
to
Roswell.
But back then, you hadn't been here that many times, and you probably didn't appreciate how desolate it was.
Correct.
It was.
Right, I live.
I mean, I live in this part of the country, not exactly here in Oklahoma, but I still don't appreciate it till I get out here.
When you go out in the desert, it is certainly, and Don and I have been lost out there several times. It is certainly a lonely feeling.
When you came to Roswell the first time, what was your? You hadn't met Don yet, right? Or had you?
No, in fact, Don and I only meet when we're in Roswell, because
okay.
He lives in Wisconsin and I live in Pennsylvania, so we only meet when we're down here.
I guess what I'm getting at before we go to the break here is, you know, in reporting, we get the feeling when you get to a story and you still don't have any facts, but you just have a feeling there's something there.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
We certainly had the listen. We are following the facts. If the facts lead to a weather balloon, we will tell your audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you that the facts, the testimony, everything that we are getting over the last 15 or so years has been leading to one conclusion, that in fact it was a UFO that crashed in 1947.
When we come back, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out about the stories of the victims and what you found out. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin. Our guest, of course, is Tom Carey, and we'll talk about his new book and his sci-fi project as well, and the book he wrote with Dick Schmidt here in a moment. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is the UFO Files. We're broadcasting from the UFO Research Library, actually, here at the International UFO Museum. I'm Jerry Pippin. We have with us Tom Carey, witness to Roswell. Tom, you've been having several lectures and roundtable discussions, and you had a pretty interesting one this morning, I understand. I'm sorry I missed it. I know Don Schmidt is here, and as well as Stanton Friedman, all of you have been involved in the same subject.
Yes.
But it seems to me, as long as you guys have been doing it, you still come up with new information all the time.
That's what keeps us going. We are on this case, we are investigating this case to one of several alternatives happens. We solve the case, which is the most optimal choice. We solve the case, go on to another one. Either that, or we run out of witnesses. And I have to tell you that the primary witnesses from the time period are mostly all gone.
Yeah, the time is getting you on that one.
Yes, it's the World War II generation we're talking about, and they're mostly, according to government statistics, on the veterans, they're less than a quarter of the veterans who served in World War II are still with
alive.
Us. Yes.
So that is a problem. Then you end up getting second.
Yes,
and third,
we find ourselves almost exclusively now talking to the children who are themselves now getting old. We had one of the children pass on 2 weeks ago from the sheriff's office here, and who was the sheriff back in 47. His daughter passed away 2 weeks ago. Even the grandchildren are now in their late teens and early 20s. And the third thing that might happen is Don or I pass on. before we solve this. Those are the three terminal events.
Let's hope the final terminal event doesn't happen. You basically are doing your research away from official government sources, correct?
Absolutely. We do not expect anything from the government. They say it was a weather balloon, and we have no expectations that they will release any data. We're not even looking in that direction. There is one item, though. It's called the Ramey Memo. It's just a telex that General Ramey, who was the architect of the Roswell cover-up, is holding in his hand when his picture was taken back in the 1947.
Right. It's an interesting little photograph. Why don't you give me your take on it? I know Rudiak, we had him recently. And
David Rudiak, yeah. Yes. My take on it, certainly Rudiak has done the best work on it. And he has been able to, quote-unquote, read more than anybody else. But it's clear that the memo itself, it's not the general's laundry list or his grocery list or his furniture packing list. It's talking about the most powerful phrase in the memo is victims of the wreck. What sort of balloon has victims? It's right there. You can see it. We know the origin of this memo. It's in the general's hand. It's talking about victims of the wreck. It's talking about flying material out. It's talking about staging weather balloon demonstrations to try to cover this thing up. It's all there in the memo. So we are still working on that, hoping to get more out of it, but I think Rudiak has, in fact, gone about as far as you can with that. The other thing we're doing is we're searching for the original. We're searching for the original. And I've talked to certain people who are professional archivists. One fellow, his name is Robert Stinnett. He recently wrote a book, well, it was in the 2000s, on Pearl Harbor, where he spent 20 years in the government archives, and he has given me a good lead as to where this particular telex might be.
Good, I hope you find it.
I know so you do too. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That would be incredible.
That's a piece of physical documentary evidence.
So as far as you know, there's no physical evidence laying around here that...
Well, we believe that whatever crashed there in 47... because of anecdotal testimony, the wind blew a lot of it around. And the idea is that if we're going to find a piece of that memory metal, we are actually not going to find it near the area of the gouge where most of the dig took place. We're going to find it in the periphery of the debris field or even away from the debris field where the wind had blown it. But that's a one in a million needle in a haystack situation. But that's where we're going to find it.
Well, basically, the reason I'm getting into that question is I want to know where you are actually going right now. I mean, you after all this time and research, you're bound to have a hunch,
yes.
Something that you're following, or at least that's kind of the way I do my work. And
we have found we have been given leads as to individuals who might possess a piece of this memory metal. So
it's conceivable, even at this point, so many years later, that somebody saved it, put it away in a trunk,
yes.
Passed it on to the children, and they
yes.
they have no idea what it is.
That's possible. That's entirely possible. But we also have leads of people who are holding pieces, and it's our goal to visit with them because we haven't visited them with them yet. But heretofore, all claims, I have to say, all claims of physical evidence have not borne fruit.
Turned out.
Right.
And that has to be frustrating.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you get your hopes up.
Yes. Because when we get a lead on physical evidence, everything else, we drop everything else.
What do you think actually involved in this crash really happened? I mean, many beings and et cetera?
Okay. There, first of all, as far as the number of craft involved, there's to Don and myself, there's only evidence of one. Others have maintained that maybe there was a collision in the air, and then one went to the plains of San Augustine, and one went down towards Roswell. We believe there was only one involved. As far as bodies, that's the a very interesting point. We believe there were approximately five bodies, potentially eight involved. Three having been found up on the ranch by Mac Brazel. And
is his son still alive?
Bill Jr. died this year.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Yes, Bill Jr. died this year. But I interviewed one of Mac Brazel's nieces this year, and she confirmed for us that Mac told her about finding what he called those unfortunate little creatures, because they didn't use the term aliens back in 47.
Sure.
An alien was someone from another country,
right,
but they called them creatures.
Right.
Yes. Unfortunate little creatures is what Mac called them. So he found, we believe, two or three, and then there were up to five, somewhere between three and five, located with the final impact of the craft north of town.
Do you think they were all dead? Or did
we know? No. We have testimony from several people that one, perhaps two, were alive.
Did when you heard all these stories from people? A lot of it's hearsay. A lot of it's extra, you know, second and third party.
Yes.
But
if you get enough hearsay,
you flush it out in your mind at least when you hear all of this. That's circumstantial, but still, you can get a good idea.
If there's enough of it, you can piece it together.
Right. And that's exactly where you guys are going. But my point is, what do these creatures really look like? Are they like the ones here in the museum?
That's a good question, because we have had several stories of what they look like. We don't believe they had those large wraparound eyes that you see with the abduction cases. Conversely, there was a gentleman a few years ago who claimed he was involved, heavily involved, and said that they looked like 10-year-old children, much like it, just with a little larger head than a 10-year-old child. We do not believe that anymore either. We think they were similar to your classic grays, short in stature. Let's say they were short in stature.
Three to four feet.
Not those black wraparound eyes, but not eyes. They were more like mongoloid eyes, but very similar to ours. A little larger, but like mongoloid. No nose, no ears, and no mouth, just a slit for mouth, and then long spindly arms and legs. But that's the best we have right now.
So they were probably classic grays, small.
Except with the black eyes.
I talked to Glenn Dennis here at the museum several times, and of course he never actually got to see
anything.
It seems to be pretty normal. I mean, many, many people have a story that they're all short.
Right. The other witnesses we interviewed, one referred to them as little people, about 3 feet tall. So they're calling them little people, little creatures.
Was the craft pretty much destroyed, or?
That's another good question. All good questions. There was so much material spread around the Foster Ranch that you figured, geez, there couldn't be much left. But we believe that there was part of it still left, which ultimately impacted north of town, and that possibly a pod, an escape pod, came down 2.5 miles from the crash site, from the Foster Ranch.
That's an interesting concept, the escape pod. That sounds logical, too. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking about the crash at Roswell. And, of course, the name of the book is Witness to Roswell by Tom Carey. And your new book is, what's it called?
The Roswell Dig Diaries.
And we'll find out a little bit more about that, too, when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. You're listening to the UFO Files. We're talking with Tom Carey here. Let's talk about Witness to Roswell. This tell us a little bit about this book, Tom. By the title, and I'm sorry I haven't read it yet.
My wife actually came up with the title. It was a compilation of 18 standalone chapters of key witness testimony, with the emphasis on visual material, photographs that I took mostly. And the idea was to put it into a magazine format that was, 8.5 by 11, that was easy to read, compelling testimony with pictures. And the feedback that we've gotten on it has been very gratifying.
What sort of pictures for our audience are you talking
Well, about? Pictures that have never before been published, such as the bomb pit area number one on the old Roswell Army Air Force Base. This is where they loaded up the bodies to fly to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We have statements from crew members as to where this was and what they did. And we actually went out there a year or two ago. You have to get permission. You just can't walk right out there because this is an operating airport now. So we went out to the bomb pit area and interviewed the gentleman who was on the craft. So we have pictures of the bomb pit area. We have new photos of the Foster Ranch. We have photos of the people involved. These are photos that have never been published
When you talk about the gentleman who was on the craft that took it to Wright-Patterson, did he get a chance to see the green?
No. What happened was that they were out.
I mean, it'd be interesting to explain how they work.
Yes.
I mean, you know, because the first thing people do is, well, how can these people not know much about this?
Well, they knew something was up because this was an unscheduled flight. And they were actually out on the skeet shooting. They were off duty, and their commanding officer came by, and the Jeep said, yeah, get ready for a special flight. So they went back to the barracks, suited up, and went out, and they said, report to bomb pit number one. And this is where they used to load up the atomic bombs. And so they're standing there, and a B-29 taxis up, and they're ordered to look away from the craft.
Literally, they said, don't look.
Yes. But, of course, they, you know,
well,
they
peek. That's an invitation.
So they turned
around. Like, I don't know if you heard the story about the Northwest Airline pilot that landed at the Air Force Base by mistake the other day. Up in South Dakota, Rapid City, the commercial airport's right up the hill.
Right.
And the Air Force made everybody pull the shades down and don't look. Well, I can just imagine those passengers sitting there not looking.
Right, yeah. Right. So the whole crew, they're facing away from the craft, looking away. But, you know, they looked over their shoulder, and they could see that they were loading up not an atomic bomb, but a crate, a wooden crate that was about 4 by 6 by about 16, just long enough for about 3-foot bodies, 4-foot bodies. So the talk on the plane was that they were related to the crash and that they were actually...
So this was already around the scuttle.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. It was around the base in...
30 seconds.
Yes, yes. So they flew on to Fort Worth, Texas, and the crate was taken off the B-29 then put onto another craft that went on to Wright-Patterson. And they picked up Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer who had been at Fort Worth being part of that press conference where they talked about the weather balloons. So they flew him back to Roswell. And when they took off, the navigator on the B-29, but going back to Roswell, his name was Felix Martucci. He said, boys, we just made the history books. Now, what kind of balloon delivery would you make the history books?
Right.
So that was the significance of bomb pit number one. Okay, so we have other shots of...
You've never run across anyone that was in charge of creating up the bodies or anything, have you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, have you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, great.
Yes. Gentleman Robert Smith was... what they did, here's what they did. There were two sets of bodies. The first set went out with a Captain Orville Pappy Henderson. And he flew them to Wright-Patterson, and he actually saw the bodies. They brought them to the hangar, Hangar Building 84, known as Hangar P3 back then. But there they were lying on the cement floor of the hangar, and he talked about that in a compelling statement, that seeing the bodies on the floor, one was alive. And that was the first group of bodies from the impact of the craft itself. Later on, it brought in what we call the smelly bodies. These were the bodies that were up at the Foster Ranch that Mac Brazel had found. They had been laying out longer than they were getting.
So they actually were decaying, or at least they smelled.
Oh, yes, the smelly bodies. And Glenn Dennis talked about the being in the hospital, and that everybody had a towel over their face because the smell was so bad. These were the bodies from the Foster Ranch. Those bodies, the smell was so bad, they stored them in a tent at the extreme south end of the base. And they were guarded by Native Americans from Colorado because they felt that they could be trusted. So when it was time to ship them, they crated them up and put them at bomb pit number one. So we have testimony from several of the soldiers who had been constructing those crates for the wreckage and the bodies.
The one that was alive, was it making any, I don't think they ever made any sound.
We have no direct testimony of any sounds that they made. We don't. We know that one appeared to be perhaps injured, perhaps mortally injured, and another one seemed to be okay, and there's rumors that it lived until 1952, and they called it EBA, EB.
We're talking about an incredible book, and I tell you, just a little bit we've discussed about it here on the air, it really gets my imagination going. I'm going to have to pick this book up and take a look at it, Tom Carey, and I apologize once again for not reading it before the interview. Witness to Roswell is the name of the book.
There's one chapter in it. Just to give you a flavor for it, it's called If You Talk, You Will Be Killed. And this is precisely what they did to the civilians. See, the military participants, they could ship out to other bases, and they could order them not to talk, which they did. But the civilians were not under the direct control of the military. And in fact, some of the civilians said, there's nothing you can do to me, I'm a civilian. And they say, well, we'll show you what we can do. So what they did is they enlisted the local sheriff to put the hammer on the civilian participants. And what the local sheriff did is he went around to them and they said, you're not going to talk about this, are you? And well, you better not talk. Because if you do talk, you will be killed. So that would be an impressive statement to me if I'm a civilian, yeah. Back in 1947.
And especially if it was the sheriff telling him that, because he has a gun.
Absolutely, and he had his deputy with him, who looked like a middle linebacker.
So by intimidation,
they kept it quiet, and of course in the military you got a loss of retirement, loss of promotion, everything.
Absolutely.
Else.
Yes. And what we found in our conducting interviews over the years, the military least likely to talk have been the careerists, the ones who've been in for 20, they're on pension, they're the least likely to talk. The ones that are most likely to talk are ones that got in and got out.
Now, when we talk about Witness to Roswell, and you've obviously done quite a lot of research on this book, and the book, you know, with the interesting photographs and the way you talk about it, I mean, it's just to get you on the edge of your chair listening to you talk about it. I mean, you had to be really carried away with some of the things they were telling you.
Absolutely. What happens is when we get a new witness, and even though we've been on the case 15 years, a chill goes down our spine when we get a new witness. It's just thrilling to us.
I imagine the adrenaline flows and the excitement at the same time.
Yes, yes.
Any new witnesses this trip out? Gotta get an exclusive.
On this trip, we are still working on one that we found on our last trip. We've been so busy on this trip with the festival and doing interviews that we haven't had a chance to get out into the field and actually...
going to do that before you leave?
Yes, yes. But we do have a new witness that we found the last trip who was actively involved in the recovery from the site to the hangar and at the hospital where they did the autopsies.
So actually, this new witness saw the bodies.
Yes.
Was at the hospital with them, so was there when they transported them.
Yes.
And
he is still a work in progress. He was very reluctant to talk to us. And he was very emotional when he was telling us about this.
I don't want to get any trade secrets here, but I guess you were tipped about him or something? Or
we had a third party notify us of this particular individual. They live in the same town. And even with that, we used her as the intermediary. It was very difficult, and we were thankful that we were able to meet with him because he didn't want to meet with us originally.
In fact, this seems to be one of the regular scenarios. These people just really don't want to talk about these things.
The regular scenario is this. You have a friend, they will say, hey, you know, don't tell anybody, but I was involved in that Roswell case back in 47. This is what I did, blah, 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 blah. Don't tell anybody. They come here to the museum, and there's something about the museum that people open up. And they tell the director, who then tells us. We try to interview the person, and normally the original source, it's very difficult to get them to talk. They will either deny it or say, well, I have nothing to say.
And a lot of times, I imagine they say, I don't have anything to say, and if you keep talking to them, if they'll stay around long enough, you can probably get them to open up.
Sometimes, yes, sometimes. Sometimes they're not too pleasant, but that's the chance we take. But it's very, very difficult. And people who have offered to help us on this case, this is a scenario they can't seem to overcome. It's the rejection, because we meet a lot of rejection.
Well, I imagine so. You make a good sighting salesman. I'm teasing. It's a joke. Anyway, we of course are talking with Tom Carey here, and we're talking about Witness to Roswell. And we're at the UFO, the International UFO Museum and Research Center, and this is quite a research center in here.
Yes, yes. This is the central focus for all Roswell information, both incoming and outgoing. And we feel lucky to be associated with it because this is where the new leads are coming.
And as you say, they do open up when they come here to the museum.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting, and at the same time, I guess, understandable in
a
way.
Yes, yes, because you see all of the displays, and you start thinking, well, geez, I have something to add.
Sure.
And that's the way it works.
And so a lot of people don't think about it, but when they formed this museum and put it here, they really did a big public service as far as information.
The museum itself is the top attraction, tourist attraction in all of New Mexico. It's one of the top 20 in the nation. And it started, I think, in 91 or 92 from the old, some building. And we're now in I think it's the former Plains Theater.
They still have the marquee out front, or at least the looking, it looks like a movie theater. It's a very interesting place, and it's got a good history in itself. We, of course, are talking about Roswell, and I want to talk about the digs before we close out the show here, because you're very interested in that. Your main focus is the witness avenue, or what?
Well, we have several main focuses, or foci. Of course, whatever comes along, we will take. But it's the search for physical evidence is number one. Number two is the new witnesses that can corroborate what's already gone forward, and document search. So that's where we're focused.
It's amazing, you know, but you mentioned document search, and all of a sudden, out of some place where people have been four or five times, I imagine somebody else finds something sometimes. It just kind of works out. I know that picture, for instance, you were talking about earlier. And before computers, people didn't pay much attention to that, but it was able to blow up the print now.
Correct. Before computers, they just did optical enhancement. But
we're gonna wrap up the show when we come right back to talk about the scientific angle here. And there's still some questions I have about the dig, and maybe there'll be future digs, right, Tom?
Yes.
We're working on that. At least they are. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is the UFO Files. Tom Carey, let's talk about the new book. It's just out, and it's incredible. Science fiction channel, of course, the Sci-Fi Channel, I guess they were instrumental in publishing this book,
yes,
as well?
It was a Sci-Fi Channel publication. The publisher was Simon & Schuster, the Pocketbooks division.
Now you can, of course, get those books at any bookstore, including this one, I imagine, and
yes.
You have a way to sell it on your website, too, I imagine, or a link,
yes,
at least.
We have a link from our website for both Witness to Roswell and the one will be put up for the Roswell Dig Diaries. I think the complete title is Sci-Fi Channel Declassified, the Roswell Dig Diaries, but on the cover it just says the Roswell Dig Diaries. They will be at all your local bookstores next week, as I understand it, and certainly you can purchase them there or at the museum here in Roswell over the internet.
Interesting thing about this scientific angle is that a lot of people, you know, the debunkers go along, and they sometimes don't take into account some of the scientific examples that you've come up with already. And if you get to continue, the University of New Mexico is still helping you, correct?
Yes, they are committed. Whoever will fund our next dig, we're still going with the University of New Mexico.
And they do have the expertise because they're in this part of the country,
absolutely.
So they know what is foreign.
They are experts for this area, and we've just used techniques that they normally use in any archaeological dig. That's all we asked of them.
So you're looking for that magic metal.
The memory metal,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and how do you seem convinced that exists, or at least it did.
We've had so many descriptions of it from people that we trust their opinion. Bill Brazel Jr., for one. He described it that he found the piece 2 years after the event up on the ranch, and he described its properties. Another witness here in town, Frankie Rowe, her father was a fireman who was out to the site. She saw a piece at the firehouse, and she vividly described how it would just flow out like liquid mercury on the table, and you couldn't cut it, scratch it, or deform it in any way. So the thing about the memory metal is that you don't have to send it away to a laboratory and wonder whatever happened to it 2 years later. You can tell that this is something extraordinary. You can see it right in front of you. So that's why we're looking for that. Say a piece of the ship that's a rigid piece, again with strong properties, you would have to send that away to be analyzed. And all of these claims of physical evidence that have been sent away, we never hear any more about them.
What happened?
Don't know. It's either, usually you can speculate that it never was.
It just, you knew you sent that package, but they never got it?
They either never got it, someone else intercepted it, or when they analyzed it, it really wasn't really what was cracked up to be.
Final question before we let you go here. Have you had any intimidation factors yourself in
No.
this investigation? None of
No.
them?
No.
From nobody, so. Other than people reluctant and upset, didn't want to talk to you, but I mean, nothing official.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, thank you very much, Tom, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Have fun out here in New Mexico, and have a nice trip back to Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Jerry. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. Well,